good life. I have worked hard. I have been a lucky man. I have not suffered the bad reactions and the nightmares one hears can happen to veterans. I have always been careful not to get into fights for fear I would unthinkingly use my skills and kill somebody. I have lived as a peaceable person, trying to do the right thing. Until recent years, when I have become unapproachable because of my gloominess. My first wife left me, and later other wives left me. I don't blame them. I have a hatred for life. I keep thinking about those boys I killed. How they didn't get to live a life, any kind of life, good or bad. I took their lives from them. I cannot forgive myself for this. I find I'm thinking about it almost constantly. I can see their faces, which, because of me, are not always attached to their bodies. Crying heads. And so, I heard about you, and I thought maybe it would help to tell you about it. People say that confession is good for the soul. But I can already tell it hasn't helped. I'm not afraid to die. Death is just over and out. I think that is the answer.
Life is suffering. You have heard about the penitents who in the old days carried huge wooden crosses on their backs to express contrition for their sins. Well, you are carrying a very heavy cross, only it is in your head and heart. Give me your hand. I think you were wise to put your warrior years behind you, not to continue with violence or let your memories drag you down into the mire. You have lived a decent life, and it is because you are a good man that you are thinking these thoughts that fill you with sorrow. Jacob, I believe that we can create ourselves anew each day, and you have had 30 years to do so. You are not a killer anymore. But if you take your life, you will die a killer. Your last breath will be the breath of a killer.
I know. But I can't take it anymore. Goodbye.
I was worried about Jacob, so I went quickly and found Ho, the cellist. You must follow that man down the mountain and stay with him. If he goes to a bar, drink with him. If he tries to kill himself, protect him. He's scared because he's just let his demons out of their box. But I believe that if he can survive this night, he will begin to be better. Ho, imagine a man who fought 3 years in Vietnam, leaving a toll of uncountable dead, and has never spoken a word about it to anyone until today. He is from a country that has no Vietnam veterans. His shame and guilt are unendurable, but worst of all is his loneliness.
Ho was a veteran of a war in China. It didn't matter that it wasn't Vietnam. All wars are the same and wreak the same excruciating sorrow. Ho had come to Joe with the same feelings as the man who had just left. There were men all over the world with these feelings. So had it always been. So it would always be, until there was an end to ignorance, anger, and greed, and men treated each other with honor, as they would treat a holy man.
I found Jacob sitting on the fence, watching the dappled ponies. I introduced myself, then climbed upon the top rail next to the legionnaire, who sat with one hand, palm up, nestled in the other, an unconscious lotus position. Jacob's face, that had released itself into lines last night, was now worn into grooves from the tears he had shed with the holy man.
There is nothing more to say, Ho. My mind is made up. I have only stopped for a minute on my way to the grave to observe this baffling game.
It is up to you. I understand. I was a veteran, too. So was Joe. Not long after he returned from his war, which was the Second World War, as if he hadn't seen enough of blood and death, his wife and child were killed in a car accident. He was in his 20s then.
Ho told Jacob about Joe's life, and Jacob listened with a keen interest. Periodically, the ponies galloped past them or scrambled together in front of them as their riders competed for the ball. He told about Joe's suffering, his wandering, searching, studying, learning from different sages, finally coming to this mountain to build his hermitage. Ho spoke of all the people who had, like himself, come to live with Joe and learn from him, but how Joe always sent them back out into the world to enrich it.
Now he is old, and some of us are afraid he is not very well. The time has come for him to choose someone to take his place. He has been waiting for many years for a special person he said was coming, but I guess she has given up. We thought he might have especially called us together this summer to choose one of us. There is one monk who ardently wishes to be chosen.
I hope he will not choose that one.
Today, there is a rumor floating around among us that Joe found someone from the line who is the one he has been waiting for, but that he lost that person. So now, Jacob, I have to humbly admit my real purpose in following you is to ask if you came to know anyone in the line who was remarkable.
Yes, Anna, of course. Anyone will tell you she is very unusual. Why didn't the holy man ask her to stay?
Well, he certainly wanted to. But Joe is humble, you know. And I think it seemed to him that what she was doing in the world was more important than sharing the last days of an old man like him.
It is not funny. It seems like a terrible misunderstanding. I don't think either Anna or Joe would like to hear you laugh. Maybe you are the man who is so eager to be chosen.
Maybe I am. Who wouldn't want to take the place of the holy man who have the whole world come to sit at his feet? Not that Joe lets anyone sit at his feet.
A monk should not be ambitious. Joe would not want such a one to take his place.
Quite right. But this Anna, in her goodness, harbored no such desire and therefore went away. What is one to do?
It is a puzzle.
I must go on to the town for supplies. I hope you will be all right. What is the matter with your hand? You seem to be nursing it.
This? Well, you see, the holy man held this hand in his own. So now I am thinking, how can I possibly turn it against myself, this blessed hand? Instead, I must put it to some good work. I have an idea what I could do.
That night in the common room, Ho sat down next to Joe and Helena.
Joe, your legionnaire Jacob stopped to watch the game and was so entranced he forgot for a time that he was hell-bent on putting an end to himself.
Yes, but what about when he remembers? Such anguish as he feels will be uppermost in his mind.
We had a long talk, and I gave him something else to think about. I spurred him into action. Unlike our stumpy-legged ponies, old warriors need to be spurred on.
Yes. Meanwhile, the game is an excellent distraction. It's funny how you forget about it, except when you're there, and then you can hardly tear yourself away.
What game?
The one with the ponies.
The dappled ponies down there in the pasture?
Yes. It's sort of like polo. You ride the ponies and hit a boar toward a goal with a mallet, if the boar hasn't already got away from you by rolling way downhill in the opposite direction.
Oh, I've been up and down that trail 100 times, and I've never seen this game you're speaking of.
Have you seen the ponies running up and down and doing the twists and turns and fancy steps?
Yes.
Well, not everyone sees the riders.
Come on.
It's true. The riders are ghosts. I think they are ghosts of old warriors because it seems that only those who have been to war can see them.
You mean only veterans are cracked enough to think they can see them?
Let's go outside.
The stars look so close you could run your fingers through them. Remember you told me how you completely lost your reason over that game? You were so fascinated by it, you just about gave up being a holy man and spent all your time down there watching.
Yes, I remember. Along with everything else about it, it seemed to be a parable for life. Going forwards and backwards and round in circles, striving ever forward, only to have to run like crazy backwards to get the ball again, realizing that your enemy is after the same goal and you're actually helping him towards it and getting roughed up and possibly killed while you're at it, but still feeling the comradeship of being in the game all together. Well, naturally, I figured that if I could only understand the game, well, then I would understand the meaning of life.
And?
Well, I came to realize that I'd better go back to the hermitage to eat and sleep and do my chores, or I was going to die sitting there on that fence. And before that, I was going to go crazy, like Buddha under the Bodhi tree, sitting and fasting, realizing he wasn't going to reach samsara if he didn't get something to eat.
So what do you think of my theory? Do you think the riders are ghosts of dead warriors? Or maybe could it be that we survivors are the ghosts?
You? A ghost, Ho? Well, what a joke. You are not only alive, you're awake.
Kim left the enthusiastic young runners of the town who had been accompanying him up the mountain and started up the hermitage trail, moving fast and efficiently, breathing calmly, monitoring himself so as not to get into oxygen debt as he fought gravity to the top. His sure feet knew the trail so well, every rock and root, twist and slant, that he felt he could close his eyes. But he didn't. Every path, no matter how well known, contains the unexpected.
I was, as always, utterly happy while running, in accord with nature, in harmony with the universe, in touch with the truth that is in me, full of love for all creatures, even to the lowliest insect. Sometimes I thought that if I wasn't blessed with this gift of running, I would not be a good monk, would not even be a good person. It somehow made me feel I was cheating. I should talk to Joe about it, if I can find the words.
Kim was Korean, small, lithe, intricately muscular. His dark eyes danced with light. His hair, even cut close to his skull, had the black iridescence of a starling's wing, and his teeth were almost blindingly white. Everything about him seemed tuned to a higher degree than other mortals. He reached the hermitage in one of his best times and, as always, his heart sang to see the sturdy white house sitting amidst the tumbled boulders.
I had a shower and then went to look for Joe. By now it was evening and Joe was sitting alone in the backyard with a volume of poetry in his lap, seated on a large boulder. But looking outward, as if he were taking the words in through his thighs. He probably knows the poems by heart anyway. I sat down beside him on the boulder, a long one I had tipped over to make a bench. The liquid sound of Ho's cello wafted faintly from the common room window, as if the far-flung stars were sending a message.
What's on your mind, Kim?
When I am running, I attain that no mind that we all seek. That perfect emptiness, the oneness. I'm not alone in that. It is nothing special, I guess, for anyone who works with devotion. I have talked with other athletes about it, artists too. But Joe, given this happiness as a part of my daily life, it seems easy for me to be loving and kind. Is this true?
I think it is easier for the happy person to be kind. But also it follows that a kind person is a happy person.
I feel as if it is too easy for me.
Look what you have gone through to be the athlete you are. Incredible discipline. Unbearable loneliness. Denying yourself the food and drinks, festivities other young people enjoy. Enduring hours of tortuous training every single day, all the while understanding you must be willing, when the time comes, to undergo the anguish of losing the race. Always understanding that one day you might hurt yourself and fall out of the race forever. And finally, accepting that, inescapably, you will grow old and slow. No, Kim. No, it's not so easy for you.
It feels easy.
Because you are a Buddha.
Can I stay here with you, Joe?
Forever? No, Kim. Not yet. It's good for you to be out in the world.
You always tell us that.
Well, because it's true, particularly for you. Many more people see you than see me as you run marathons through the great capitals of the world. They get to see up close what a holy man looks like and behaves like, because millions watching television see the grace and humility with which you accept the laurel wreath and listen carefully to the worthy words that you say. You are an inspiration. I've heard that you never reply to the reporter's questions, but that in the happiness of the moment, pure poetry flies from your tongue. Now, apparently, they don't even ask you about the race. Just wait to hear what you have to say about anything. Well, I wouldn't deprive the world of you, Kim.
Isn't this hermitage the world? Isn't this boulder the world?
Yes. Yes, this boulder is the world, Kim. But, there's no TV.
Daniel, the dancer, was born in South America and was part Indian, part Spanish. As a young, high-spirited youth, he had come with friends on a lark to the Hermitage, but then, moved by Joe's message, had stayed for a year. As time passed and he became a star performer, he returned often to the Hermitage but gradually wandered off the path that Joe had set him upon. However, he was gifted in hiding his fall from grace from others. Now he stood at Joe's door with his uncannily perfect posture, his still beautiful face.
Come in. Please sit down, do.
Joe, I want to stay.
Most of you want to stay, but I must tell you, as I've told the others, that I need to be alone in the winter.
Maybe you're not considering the dangers. I think I should be with you.
But what about your dancing, Daniel?
I am finished. I am too old now. Because you urged all of us to give most of our money away, I cannot return to my country as a man of substance. I will not be respected if I don't have a fine house, a really big house. That matters in my country. In any country. Sad but true. So, I want to remain here with you.
Who are these people whose respect you so badly want?
Just people. The man on the street, the men in the other fine houses, women,
I know it isn't right to feel that, but I do.
But what about your friends? Isn't their respect more important than those anonymous hordes? I thought you didn't want to retire. You were going to teach. You're only 40.
I'm old, and I'm sore, and I'm tired.
Those feelings will pass. Ask yourself which is the better of these two pictures 10 years from now. The first picture is you in a fine house in any country of your choice, entertaining people you don't care about, eating and drinking too much, getting further into debt, divorced from the dancer's art and the music you love. But the second picture is of you at 50, passing on your knowledge to the young dancers who adore you and urge you every night to take supper with them, who come to you with their personal problems, as well as their hopes and fears. Your apartment is small, but sitting in its chairs are people who want to be with you, Daniel, not strangers to make merry at your expense. And among your students is one boy or girl who you can already tell will be as great a dancer as you were, greater than you. So that when you're 60 and 70, you can say to yourself with satisfaction and pleasure, I was his teacher. And the young dancers will talk amongst themselves and ask each other, if Daniel was so famous, he must have made piles of money. Why does he live so simply and work so hard for us all? And some old-timer will answer, don't you know? He gave all his money to create scholarships for poor dancers. Really? They'll exclaim. But that's fantastic. And that's the most talking I've done since the woman who wanted to die visited. Really. The holy chatterbox strikes again.
You were always telling us to go back into the world and do our work. But I feel it's a finer thing to stay here and live as you do, to give it all up completely. I didn't say that I don't want to teach, that I really don't like the young dancers, nor they me. Oh, I know they admired me, or had until recently, when I began to fail and lose the luster of fame, take on the hated taint of a has-been. And I was ashamed to tell Joe that I hadn't created the scholarships he had referred to, although at one time I'd honestly meant to. Instead, I'd made bad investments, throwing good money after bad, always thinking the scholarships could wait until I recouped my losses. But now, I could see how I could still be a star for the rest of my life, if I could be chosen as Joe's successor.
Daniel knew that Joe was at the end of his life. The one he had waited for had not come, or, if the rumors were true, had come and then gone. Daniel believed Joe had asked his 7 favorites there for the summer to choose from among them, and he felt he was the best choice. If nothing else, he looked the part, had a breathtaking, charismatic presence that Joe, in truth, sage though he was, didn't have at all.
Joe, if you don't want me here, I will stay in the town for the winter. You will be able to call me if you need me. I will return to the hermitage in the spring to see that you are all right.
Because there were no pictures of the holy man in the world, because Joe and the monks all dressed alike and all equitably took their turns at going for supplies, indistinguishable from one another, Daniel presumed the townspeople thought the holy man remained always in his mountain aerie, ever unseen by any of them. Also, because most of the pilgrims were rushed through the house with head-spinning speed, Daniel believed that few in the world would question the identity of the holy man if it were changed. It briefly occurred to Daniel, flickered through his mind, that if Joe did not survive the winter, he could be on hand to discover the event and simply take his place as the holy man, with no one the wiser. He was scared by the audacity of the thought, and then, when Joe's eyes rested on his, Daniel felt more scared that Joe was reading his mind. His heart accelerated, and he flushed. Quickly, He lowered his eyes as he stood to go.
I'll leave you now, Joe. But I would ask you to think about what I've proposed.
I know all the townspeople. I played with them all as children. You would enjoy a winter in town. But no. You must go back to your work.
You are right, of course.
We are born, we suffer, we die. However, love is a possibility for us all, and for some few, there is also a big house.
Need they be mutually exclusive? Can we have both love and house?
Certainly. But one must consider carefully how one goes about getting the house.
On one of the last evenings in the common room, Maria came up with some interesting news.
Do you remember that early in the summer, Helena and I discovered a meadow full of dandelions? And that we picked them, then combining our respective skills at science and cuisine, made a vat of dandelion wine, then bottled it. Yes.
Well, since we're soon to leave, and who knows when we'll all be together again, maybe we should broach a few bottles and see how it tastes.
Good idea.
Yes, that would cheer us all up. It'll be interesting to see what it tastes like.
Yeah.
Wow! That's a beautiful color. It's kind of a shimmering amber.
It certainly goes down very well.
Delicious.
The light-hearted concoction seemed to have no effect at first, but only because the kick was slow to arrive. It was a nonsense kick when it came. 1 minute, they were decorously sitting about, idly, even gloomily, chatting. And the next, they were up and dancing, telling stories, doing stunts, laughing their heads off, reciting poems, and seeing who could make the funniest face.
Hi. What's all this noise about? I see. You've been trying out the dandelion wine.
Yes.
A little bit.
What a good idea. It's only left for me.
There was. They all made merry through the evening, forgetting dinner entirely. And when it was time for bed, nobody went, but instead slumbered together in a big wheat-colored pile, dreaming bright yellow, soft-petaled dreams. There were only a few days left in which the Holy Man would be receiving pilgrims. The nights had already turned cold, and this morning a brief dry snow had fallen. Flakes that were no more than specks of glitter drifting lazily from the sky. In the woods of clattering leaves, the ginkgo trees had turned yellow and soft so that the perpetual clattering ceased, replaced by a whispering sound of time to leave, time to die, until one after another they floated to the forest floor. The hay was in for the stumpy-legged ponies who would soon be stabled for the winter. The boulder birds had flown away south. The last cord of wood had been chopped and split for the hermitage stove.
I need 6 cords to see me through the winter. The monks are all getting ready to leave. But all of them, except for Ho, who thinks I'll be fine, are still offering to stay, or telling me that I should winter in the town. But I've told them. They must return to their individual work with renewed creativity and passion. And I must stay here, in my home. There are too many distractions in the town.
You see, I think that winter is my most fruitful season for thinking. And maybe it's time to write down some of my thoughts.
You always said that you didn't believe in writing them down. That they got altered by trying to pin them down. That you had to pass on your teachings in person.
Well, I'm not so inflexible that I can't change my mind about things.
That's another reason why you didn't write them down. Because you said once the words were printed, you couldn't change your mind.
You know, you're all getting so argumentative about everything. I'm going to be glad to be rid of you. Now, go away. What's the trouble with intimacy? You have lost your awe of me and you treat me like a child.
I know. Instead of worshipping you, we love you.
Today I will do the rice run. I reckon I will need £20. I know you all want to come with me and help me carry it back up the hill, but I do want to do this on my own.
They didn't argue with him about this one thing because they knew that the rice run was sacrosanct. Usually when Joe went to town, the pilgrims were told that he wouldn't be receiving that day, so they wouldn't stand in line needlessly. But this day, they were not told, and so formed their line as usual.
It's almost winter. How many more days will he see us?
And now that we've seen the first snow, even though it's light, maybe we should think about heading back to town.
When I got to town, I went to the park to play with the children.
This is my last visit until the spring, but you will see me at the first thaw. I love the winter time except for not seeing you children. I learn so much from you all. You're all so good.
Oh, no. We're not good at all. I beat up my little sister.
And I didn't do what my mother told me. And I've been cheeky to her.
And I keep skipping school.
And I stole some candy from the store.
You're all good as gold, and I love you with all my heart.
We love you too, Joe. We wish it didn't have to be winter.
Well, nothing lasts. Everything changes. But the changes are the same. Winter will always turn to spring.
Will you always come down at the first thaw, like you have every year?
As long as I can still put one foot in front of the other.
If you can't, we'll come up to see you.
What a good idea.
Joe bid them all goodbye, then struggled up the path with a 20-pound bag of rice, making frequent stops, not because he needed to so much, but because he enjoyed prolonging his last trip. At one point, as he took a shortcut across an open field, wild chrysanthemums grew up in his footsteps. The last half mile was the steepest, and that was where the line began. He set down the rice.
My goodness, that's heavy. I'm not as strong as I used to be.
I can't leave my place in line, or I'd help you. But I tell you what, we'll pass the bag along the line, and you can walk beside it.
Oh, what a good idea.
So we passed the bag of rice along, hands to hands, and Joe walked along, greeting everyone, smiling upon us, touching us.
This is so kind of you, to help out an old man. If you will treat everyone you meet with such helpfulness and kindness, you too will be a happy person.
And it gradually dawned on us that he was the holy man. We'd gotten to see the holy man after all.
The pilgrims were gone. The trail began to heal, and in the hermitage, Joe healed too. The second floor was closed off for the winter, and Joe made his home in the kitchen with a wood-burning stove. He pushed the long table against the wall and, having brought down his mattress from the bedroom, put it on top. He brought a table, a straight-back chair, and a comfortable armchair from the common room. The winter outhouse, built high for the snow, wasn't far from the kitchen door, and Joe had snowshoes.
I felt mortally tired. It had been a long summer, and I realized that seeing hundreds of people almost every day had taken it out of me, more so than in previous years. Maybe because of my heart. I was happy to be alone and to replenish myself.
But many years had passed since he'd been totally alone. He was in his 20s when he gave back his wife and daughter, and that was when he dropped out of the life he'd known. Then he began to roam the world in search of meaning. He was solitary until, in Cambodia, he found the right teacher and stayed with him for almost 10 years before coming here to build the hermitage, when it was the size of what is now the kitchen. Truly a hermit, he lived alone for several years until people began to seek him out.
I have been here 25 years. It's hard to believe. I feel I might have accomplished something in that time. I hope so.
The winter weeks went by, then a month, then two. Joe began to feel a little lonely and useless, He was a teacher to the bone. It was hard to have no one to teach. He slept a lot and dreamed dreams. Sometimes he wondered if his waking moments were the dream, if it were summer really, and he was only dreaming that he was alone in the hermitage, surrounded by impenetrable snow.
I found myself wondering exactly why I was alone, and then I remembered that I had forbidden anyone to stay with me. So it was entirely up to me. Then I would remember the one who had come and gone.
Always Joe had carried his part of the hermitage load, taking his turn to cook, to sweep, or wash up, taking his turn to go to town for supplies. But the truth was, the monks looked after him more than he realized, and cooking every day was different from cooking once a week. Rice, beans, or bread took nearly an hour to cook, and often, lost in his thoughts, he'd burn them.
There were days when all I had was cups of tea and broth.
So it was that no sooner had he rested and restored his strength from the rigors of the summer than he began to lose strength for lack of food and to grow lightheaded, not realizing he wasn't eating enough. One day, Joe set his heart pills down on the counter. Later, absent-mindedly, moved a jar in front of them and never saw them again.
I realized that living alone, I had no routine. I often didn't know where in the day I was. Was it meditation time? Or the hours for chores? Time to sleep, or had I just got up? Silent time presented no scheduling problems. That was constant. And the snow, drifting high against the kitchen windows, added to my disorientation. I realized I had to take myself in hand, care for myself, put order in my day, pay attention. And once I did so, my mind became as clear as a running stream.
But then the roof of the storeroom collapsed under the weight of snow. Possibly, this was the part of the new roof the poet Ed had worked on during his shirking period.
So now, most of my supplies were cut off. Now I had to spend part of each day clearing away the fallen timbers and rubble just to get to my food, a task I found a little beyond my strength. But I was determined to carry on.
On a late afternoon, during the tail end of a storm that had been wailing for several days, Joe was astonished to hear a knock on the door. Luckily, the kitchen was situated near the front door, or he never would have heard it. Still, he doubted his ears. Maybe it was a tree branch hitting the door from the wind. But he reminded himself there were no trees at this elevation, just boulders, and the wind could not move the boulders, only Kim could. But the light knocking continued.
So I went to the door and opened it. Wonder of wonders. There stood a little boy, about 5 years old. Because the snow came halfway up the door, he stood at eye level with me. My first thought was that the spring thaw might have come to the town below, so the children had come up the mountain to look for me. But the towering drifts of snow and the large, wet, intricate flakes still falling made that impossible.
What miracle is this? Let me get you down.
I've come to stay with you. My name is Jimmy.
Did you drop from the sky?
No, I was going to walk all the way, but I got tired, so Daddy carried me and Jacob carried Daddy's pack. You see, Jacob came and got us.
Jacob?
Hello, Joe. My name is Aaron. I'm Jimmy's dad.
He had bright, intelligent green eyes, black curly hair. The pack on his back, when unmuffled, revealed itself to be a small girl child, lying fast asleep in her cocoon of wraps.
Now this is Melissa.
Joe's heart filled with joy to think he would have children here in his mountain fastness, for it truly looked as if this family had come to stay. He knew not why, or how, or from whence.
But it was the boy I kept looking at, because I felt I knew that dear face, those solemn eyes, that gentle smile.
He was going to close the door and shepherd them to the warm kitchen when a large man appeared through the storm with an enormous pack on his back. It was Jacob, the despondent legionnaire. But his was no longer the sad face of the grieving warrior. It was ruddy with health and good spirits, and the joy of accomplishment. He took off his snowshoes, shook the snow from his coat, and stepped down into the hermitage.
Good afternoon, holy man.
As Joe was about to greet him, he was distracted by yet another arrival, a slight figure who appeared at the top of the trail and struggled across the yard, buffeted by the wind. She came toward him through the snow, ran the last few steps, and flung herself into his arms. It was Anna. It was the one. Spring came late to the holy man's hermitage. The mountain was awash with water. It sang with the sound of rivulets, streams, creeks, and cataracts, all rushing to the reservoir in the town 10 miles below. The wild iris began to shyly appear, pale lilac, the color of the melting snow itself, and of the mountain light just before dawn. The boulder birds returned, looking a bit straggly and stunned, as if having flown through a tempest, but happy to find the same boulders to alight on at last and sing a song about. The steady rocks were paradise after the long, wind-tossed, rain-jostled journey from the south.
I wandered about outside, feeling a little stunned and surprised to be around to greet another spring on my beloved mountain. Just when things had looked their worst during the hard winter months, when my heart, physically and metaphorically, was giving out, Anna had appeared, with her husband and children, to nurse me back to health. Amazing. Jacob, the pilgrim, who had been a killer but was now redeemed, had found them in Dublin and brought them to the hermitage as a gift to me. And the greatest part of it was the sound of the children's laughter, which made me determined to hang on to life a little longer, so I could pass on my wisdom to Anna, my chosen one.
Joe strolled about the boulder garden and greeted the returning birds who had lit on him as well as the boulders, not because he was the holy man, they didn't know that, but because something about Joe was like a rock, steady and safe, one with the ground and the air, warmed by the sun, celebrating the wind and rain. This, although he was a small, frail, plain-looking man of 73 years. Joe stood for a long time when a boulder bird sat on his shoulder. It was something he could do well, and yet another thing he must remember to teach Anna before he died, to be still. But Anna was watching from the window, and already learning. She rarely took her eyes off the holy man, because she knew it was her job now to be learning from him, and there was nothing she would rather do than be with Joe and try to do as he did.
And so I stood still, being a rock, for an hour, with birds on my head and shoulders and one on my foot, all of them coming and going, but mostly staying. While in this posture, I watched the clouds move across the sky. I saw a beetle stroll along the ground, six tiny alternating steps at a time, and disappear into the new green spears of grass near the spring. Two small blue butterflies whirled around each other in an intricate aerial dance, while a yellow one wafted aimlessly, making patterns in the air. I was having a wonderful time. But when one of the birds returned to my shoulder with a small twig in his beak, I figured it was time to stop being a rock. Good though I am at remaining still for long periods, I can't stay here for the time it would take for the bird to build a nest, lay her eggs, hatch them, and teach the chicks to fly. I don't have that much time left. And there are a few things I must attend to that are almost as important as being a rock and nest-bearer.
Slowly, he began to stir so that the birds thought it was their own idea to remove themselves from him, and not that Joe was unperching them.
I didn't want to instill in them the slightest doubt that rocks were immovable, that rocks are a safe haven.
Watching from the window, Anna was joined by Jimmy, her 5-year-old son.
What's Joe doing?
He's being a rock, I think.
Can we be rocks?
Sure. We can be anything.
Come on, then. Let's go.
To Anna, that let's go contained all the thrill of childhood. It was the exalted cry that the holy man wanted to hear from people of all ages, expressing the excitement of life's possibilities on every given day.
Although I knew the outlook wasn't good for me and Jimmy to be unwiggly rocks, we ran out to the boulder garden to try.
Jimmy was 5 years old, peaceful and thoughtful, physically strong, humorous and inventive. Melissa was 3 and a half, full of fun and imagination, a strong-minded individual. Both were kind and loving like their mother. Their father, Errol, was an intelligent, strong, capable person, an architect by profession.
He's kind and loving, but plagued, I think, by restlessness and dissatisfaction.
Errol found the hermitage to be confining in the extreme. Over the winter months, he had often gone snowshoeing on the trackless mountain, filling his family with fear. He would return exhilarated, but several times had to be saved by Jacob, who, being from the European Alps, was familiar with the wiles of ice and snow, unlike the lowland Irish Errol. Once, lost in a whiteout, Errol spent 3 days in a snow cave and almost died. His love of adventure and drama led to irresponsibility, but added to his charm. He was a captivating person.
There was one spring night, which was particularly cold, and a rainstorm driven by a northeast wind swirled around the hermitage. Errol had not returned by dark. Jacob was still exhausted from the long, weary tracking of him the last time he was lost, and so could not go and look for the errant husband. Anna and the children were tired and anxious. I said to Anna that she and the children should go to bed. I told them that I was sure Errol would soon be home, and I promised to wait up for him and have some hot potato soup ready.
Anna did what the holy man enjoined her to. Soon Joe heard bedtime stories and lullabies from the next room. Until summer and the arrival of the monks, they were using only the bottom floor, so Anna and her family slept in the common room, Jacob in the study, and Joe in the kitchen, all on mattresses taken from the beds in the rooms above.
Well, I sat in the kitchen and waited. At around midnight, there was a clawing at the door and a muffled call. I put the flame on under the pot of soup and went to the door. As I opened it, Errol fell through, but I stepped aside so he fell not into my arms, but onto the floor. His face was pale, his beard and brows covered with ice. I removed his boots for him. Come, come, into the warm kitchen.
I can't get up.
Well, then please crawl. I'm sorry, I don't have the strength to drag you.
Where's Anna? Where are the children?
They are where they're supposed to be, in bed, asleep.
It was customary for Errol's family to be up and waiting and to throw themselves on him with joy and gratitude at his being preserved once again from nature's deadly and nonchalant embrace, often crying spasmodically from the release from fear. Joe was not prepared to perform their part in the drama. He was not going to throw himself on Errol and wet his neck with tears. Nor would he let him summon his family.
Please, please. You must keep your voice down so they will not be disturbed.
They will want to know I'm all right.
Errol staggered to his feet, stripped off his outer garments, and tottered to the kitchen. Joe ladled soup into a large yellow bowl and set it in front of him. He sat down opposite Errol at the table and folded his hands together.
I've told them you were all right, and they have believed me.
But
it doesn't mean they don't love you because they were not here weeping and wringing their hands as the hours dragged on.
I know that.
Good, good. But I would like to know that you love them equally, because it seems to me you seem to rejoice in putting them again and again through this hell.
I can't help it if I get lost.
After getting lost one time, it is given to a man to understand that he doesn't know what he is doing. Twice, and he might begin to wonder why he persists in behaving like a fool. Three times, and he might wonder if he is suicidal, and is bound to deprive his family of his love and support, or if not that, ask himself if he has some underlying motive for his irresponsible behavior.
Are you judging me?
Yes.
Isn't that against your credo?
Yes. But happily, my credo, as you call it, is infinitely flexible. And although I am judging you, I am not a hanging judge.
Some sort of holy man.
Yes, well, I'm not a perfect holy man. We are talking about you, and why, if you know they love you, you want to keep upsetting your family. Do you feel threatened that Anna has come to be with me?
Of course not.
I won't be around for long, and then it will be for Anna to decide what to do, whether to remain here or not.
Shouldn't I, as the man of the family, have some say in the decision?
Ah, not necessarily.
Well, we'll see about that.
Joe wondered if he had handled the situation wrongly and decided he had, since their relationship had gone from tolerant to adversarial. Errol was scared of Anna's position as Joe's chosen one. His escapades were to assure himself of his importance to his family. Joe had been disgusted by his behavior and had voiced those feelings. He had not only judged him, he'd condemned and rebuked him. The three things a man must never do to another if he wants to live in peace.
It dawned on me that for the last 25 years, I'd been visited here at the Hermitage only by people seeking enlightenment. And Errol had come either for the ride or against his wishes, and this was my first interaction with one such as he. Pilgrims spent days, weeks, months in line to see me for a few seconds, whereas Errol, who had waltzed in on the tales of Anna and Jacob and was privileged to live daily with us, didn't want enlightenment. After tonight, he would like the situation even less, perhaps endangering Anna's own stay with me.
But there was no going back. No unsaying what Joe unwisely had said. There was only going forward. But more importantly, there was now, this moment, together in the kitchen, in the middle of the night. So Joe unfolded his hands and put his warm hand across the table and laid it on Errol's cold one. Joe's heat penetrated Errol's body at once, brought color to his face. His downturned mouth relaxed, and the usual sparkle returned to his eyes, and he raised his face to look at Joe.
Do me a favor. Cover my other hand, too.
Anna, sleepily, entered the room, looked wonderingly at the two silent men who seemed to be having a séance.
Oh, darling, I thought I heard your voice. Are you all right?
Oh, of course I am. Go back to sleep. I'll be along soon. You are not to worry about me. I am not a child.
Good night, then.
Like that?
Not bad.
And it wasn't bad, but it wasn't good, either. Errol had relinquished his dramatic role, but wasn't giving up on the role of master. However, Joe said nothing, as he should have done to begin with, silence being truly golden.
Any trouble under the sun can be overcome by silence. I should have quietly taken his hand and acknowledged his sadness without the lecturing and hectoring that went before. And yet,
Having spoken, I feel so good. If I had been quiet while seething inside with resentment, that would have been bad for us both. Instead, I expressed my feelings, and he retorted hotly and threateningly. But now we have our moment of peace, and of being our true selves.
The monks returned to the hermitage, some coming earlier than in other years, since they were concerned about Joe and how he had survived the winter. In the autumn, before they had left for their work in the world, one and all had urged Joe to spend the winter in the town below, but he had refused. First came Kim, the Korean marathoner, at 21 the youngest of the monks. A few days later from Italy came Maria, the scientist, along with the Chinese cellist Ho. A week later, the final three arrived, within hours of each other. Ed, the poet, Helena, the African-American chef, and Henri, the lawyer from France. They were a small united nation of monks.
The South American member, Daniel, did not appear. He had succumbed to greed and envy and slunk out of sight. I can't say I was surprised.
After loving greetings, cheerful welcome festivities, and long catch-up conversations into the night, there was a massive spring cleaning. The upstairs was opened up, and there ensued a mighty scrubbing down and airing out of the entire hermitage. The robes were brought out of the cupboards, washed and hung out to dry on lines that were attached to iron spikes driven into the boulders. Soon the wheat-colored garments rose and fell, whirled and flapped in the skittish puffing winds that were typical of spring at the top of the mountain.
The monks were all delighted to find Anna in residence, and we gave her a robe. We wanted to give one to Jacob, too.
No, I couldn't. I don't feel worthy.
Everyone is a holy person, and these robes don't mean we're even holier, just that we're all members of this particular community. Joe doesn't want to distinguish himself. He wants us all to look alike.
I have many more sins to wash away before I can wear this robe, and that is that.
Also, he's so incredibly macho, he's afraid to look like a fool.
That too. I am an ex-French foreign legionnaire. I am not a monk. I am a bodyguard.
A holy bodyguard.
And don't even think.